Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record, program number 862. 9/11, the Muslim Brotherhood, and the Earth Island Boogie, part 1. We will be getting to part 2 in, obviously, For the Record 863, which I hope to have ready by the end of the weekend. This is being recorded on September 11th of 2015. Now, this is, of course, the 14th anniversary of the September 11th attack. And I, for the last several years, have not done a commemorative broadcast, so to speak. I think in light of what is taking place in the Middle East, what is taking place in Ukraine, and as we will talk about in For the Record 863, 9/11, the Muslim Brotherhood, and the Earth Island Boogie Part 2, a lot of interesting things are happening with regard to China as well. I think before I launch into the meat of the argument, it might be useful to review what the Earth Island or World Island is. Apologies to veteran listeners who know about this. When one looks at a map or a globe, there is a stretch of land running from the Straits of Gibraltar all the way across Europe, the most of the Middle East, and Russia, China, and India. That gigantic stretch of land is called the Earth Island or the World Island. It contains most of the world's population, most of the world's landmass. It contains most of the world's natural resources, including oil, and geopoliticians have long looked at the Earth Island or World Island and determined that controlling that landmass was the key to world domination. And stretching across the middle of that critical piece of real estate is a vast stretch of Muslim population. And what we're going to be doing in this program is looking at some aspects of things involved with or attendant upon the September 11th attacks that are not generally discussed by most people, but that are relevant to events that have taken place, that are taking place, and that I'm very much afraid will take place. The Muslim Brotherhood is something we have spoken about many times. It is an Islamic fascist group dating back to 1928. It was allied with the Axis in World War II. It then jumped two elements of Western intelligence, including the dominant petroleum-slash-underground Reich element of CIA. And it was used as anti-communist cadre during the Cold War. There is the firmest of evidence that the Muslim Brotherhood's offshoot groups, which include Al-Qaeda, ISIS, the Hamas organization, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, and other Islamist terrorist groups, are being used as proxy warriors by elements in the West. In our discussions with Peter Lavenda about the Hitler legacy, we spoke about weaponized religion, including weaponized Islam, and the use of Islam or weaponized Islam and Islamists as proxy warriors, was forged during World War I by Max von Oppenheim, who enlisted the Ottoman Empire and Islamic elements as proxy warriors on behalf of the Central Powers, meaning Germany, Austria-Hungary, and the Ottoman Empire. Also the British, using the Arab Legion of T.H. Lawrence, a.k.a. Lawrence of Arabia, also utilized Arab Muslims as proxy warriors. There are very disturbing indications that, in fact, Muslim Brotherhood-affiliated organizations, including some who are in conflict with each other, such as ISIS to an extent and Al-Qaeda, with Al-Qaeda, as I speak, on September 11th of 2015, having more or less declared war on ISIS, or stated its opposition to ISIS. In part two, I hope to get into that a little bit deeper. The September 11th attacks were a very complex series of events, and certainly I would not fault many people for not having a complete grasp of this in this broadcast. I've done a tremendous volume of programs about the September 11th attacks, and I hope to re-emphasize some aspects of September 11th in this program and the next. Suffice it to say that when analyzing matters political, one invariably, if one is going to do one's job, one must analyze events economic, basically follow the money. And we're going to be taking a look at some aspects of the September 11th attacks, financial investigations, Operation Green Quest, the abortive attempt at interdicting terrorist monies, and we're going to talk about the economic philosophy of the Muslim Brotherhood. We're going to be taking a look at events in the Caucasus, specifically Chechnya, with indications that Al-Qaeda slash Muslim Brotherhood elements were and are being used as proxy warriors against Russia, are being used to attempt to carve out the oil-rich Caucasus from Russia. There are now Chechen Muslim fighters associated with ISIS, which in turn appears to have evolved from Muslim Brotherhood, fighting in Ukraine, of all places. Now, both the Caucasus, of course, and Ukraine, being part of Eastern Europe, are part of the Earth Island or World Island, hence my use of the term the Earth Island Boogie, because there are a lot of interesting dances taking place in that part of the world. We're going to be talking about the Muslim Brotherhood's economic philosophy and some truly alarming developments that I think could lead to a third world war. As we are speaking, the State Department is raising hackles about Russian military support for the Assad regime in Syria. And there are indications that just as, and we'll talk about this, just as Al-Qaeda and I suspect ISIS and other Islamist groups are being used as Sunni Islamist groups, I should say, are being used as proxy warriors against Russia, just as they were used against the former Soviet Union during the first Afghan war, and just as they were used in the Balkans against the former Yugoslavia and the Serbs. There are indications that the Muslim Brotherhood offshoots, such as the Chechen rebels, and other groups associated with Muslim Brotherhood and receiving financing from Saudi Arabia, just as Al-Qaeda did, are being used as proxy warriors against Russia. Russia, in turn, is supporting Shiite Islamic groups and regimes such as Iran and Syria as an attempt at using proxy defending warriors on their southern flank. And I think the possibility with Russia now moving air support units into Syria proper to fight against ISIS, I suspect, in order to interdict to an extent the flow of Chechen fighters into Ukraine, where along with the OUNB heirs currently governing Ukraine, OUNB being a Ukrainian fascist group that, like the Muslim Brotherhood, was allied with the Third Reich, although it was more closely allied with the Reich. The OUNB then also jumped to Western intelligence and became part of the anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations, worked with CIA, BND in the Galen Org, and MI6 in the Cold War. And following the Maidan coup, which itself was almost certainly a covert operation, the OUNB heirs came to power in Ukraine. I think the possibility that the Sunni-Shia proxy warfare now going on in the Middle East could escalate into a third world war and a nuclear war in a fashion not altogether unlike the way the Balkans and the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand of the Austro-Hungarian Empire touched off the First World War. I think something similar could happen in the Middle East. Hence, a review of some material and some introduction of new material. Of all of the misbegotten creatures that could be subsumed under the truther moniker, there is none worse than a fellow named Kevin Barrett. I was contacted by that sack of fresh fertilizer a year or two ago, and I can't remember off the top of my head whether he wanted to appear on my program or invited me to appear on the show that he does. But the contention by Kevin Barrett was that the Muslim Brotherhood was in fact one of the bulwarks against the New World Order. Now, in between the lines speak, sometimes the New World Order is basically used as a code word for Da Jews and the term banksters. The terms bankster and neocon are also sometimes used as code words for the Jews. Kevin Barrett and others are maintaining that, in fact, September 11th was a false flag operation that is demonstrably false. September 11th attacks were admittedly very complex. However, the notion of the controlled demolition of the World Trade Center, which is not only demonstrably false but physically impossible, and other things, that's part of the truther catechism. And to have a creature like Kevin Barrett maintaining that the Muslim Brotherhood is a defense against the New World Order, that is absolutely asinine. The Muslim Brotherhood is part and parcel to the New World Order. Now, admittedly, the September 11th attacks are a complex event. Certainly, American military personnel and American civilians have lost their lives in conflicts against organizations like Al-Qaeda, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, satellite organizations in Afghanistan and elsewhere. And, of course, the civilians who lost their lives in the September 11th attacks, the Boston Marathon bombing, and the civilians of other countries who have lost their lives in other attacks by similar Muslim Brotherhood-affiliated terrorist groups.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
It might seem to be incomprehensible to some people that, in fact, the transnational corporate community would be backing an organization like the Muslim Brotherhood and using groups like Al-Qaeda, ISIS, and related institutions, in particular the Chechen Islamist guerrillas, as proxy warriors. That might seem incomprehensible. I would simply say in that context that a relevant and extremely relevant event in this context is the Second World War, as we have seen so many times. World War II was a conflict in which American-based and other countries' large transnational corporations were actually backing Hitler and the other Axis countries because they saw the anti-communist, anti-labor, and pro-corporatist philosophy of fascism as desirable, and U.S.-based transnational corporations, as we have looked at in so many programs, including Uncle Sam and the Swastika, For the Record 731, many of our discussions with John Loftus, the heroic researcher and former head of the Office of Special Investigations, U.S. corporations were backing Hitler at the same time as American military personnel were fighting very heroically and losing their lives in conflict with the very combatant forces that American corporations were backing. That is, I think, the relevant paradigm, because something similar is going on today. Mussolini, who invented the term fascism, said, "Il fascismo e il corporatismo." Fascism is corporatism. And the pro-corporatist philosophy of fascism has, of course, endeared it to the transnational corporations. And as we will see, or really as we will review, the Muslim Brotherhood has a corporatist economic agenda which has endeared it to the transnational corporations and related institutions. And that really is the relevant concept. So when, again, a sack of fresh fertilizer like Kevin Barrett maintains that the Muslim Brotherhood is a bulwark against the New World Order, nothing could be further from the truth, because the Muslim Brotherhood is part and parcel to the New World Order. It is corporatist. What we're going to do as a point of entry into the substantive discussion is to review some information that we first presented in For the Record 367 that we looked at in 2002. We're going to begin by taking a look at a familiar name, one of the major Wall Street law firms, that of Sullivan and Cromwell, perhaps best known as the law firm in which the Dulles brothers, John Foster Dulles and Alan Dulles, toiled. Sullivan and Cromwell was the legal vehicle for the investment of many prominent corporations and associated individuals into the Third Reich. Alan Dulles was one of the shepherds for that investment. The Bush family were among those who invested in the Third Reich through the Harriman 15 and Sullivan and Cromwell. Alan Dulles then, of course, became head of the Bernd OSS, Baron Switzerland Office of the OSS, America's World War II intelligence agency and the precursor to the CIA. And Alan Dulles, of course, then became CIA director and worked very closely with the Third Reich elements and also with the Muslim Brotherhood in the post-war period. We have looked at in numerous programs the badly suppressed Operation Green Quest, when the terror financing money trail was investigated. It went directly to the Bank Al-Taqwa, to the SAR network, to networks associated with the Saudis, with the Bush family, with the Republican Party, with Grover Norquist, and Karl Rove. We looked at that in, for the record, 356, 357, and many other programs as well, including, for the record, 515, 462, 464, and 467. Ultimately, the Operation Green Quest investigation was badly attenuated. And that was because of several things, in my opinion. First of all, the fact that the powers that be, the major corporate interests in this country and their allied political and national security elements, did not want terrorist money to be interdicted. They were quite content to tolerate the casualties endured by civilians on September 11th, and in fact welcomed that event as an excuse to do many things that they intended to do, such as invading Iraq to get their hands on that oil and winning political support for the idiot child George W. Bush, the Alfred E. Newman of American politics, who was the front, the smiling moron who fronted for the powerful corporate interests who back the Muslim Brotherhood. And we're going to take a look at some key aspects of the investigation into the 9/11 money trail. We're going to begin by taking a look at an excerpt from the book Holy War Incorporated, Inside the Secret World of Osama Bin Laden, authored by Peter Bergen, and copyright 2002. An excerpt of that on page 49 reads as follows. Speaking of the Bin Laden construction firm, furthermore, the family company maintained a satellite office in Maryland during the 1990s, employs a public relations agency in Manhattan, and receives legal advice from the white shoe law firm Sullivan and Cromwell. That's right, the old Dulles law firm is the general counsel for the Bin Laden Group, Saudi Bin Laden Group. And when the investigation into the 9/11 and terror financing networks began, it was opposed by a consortium of financial institutions, and walking point for those financial institutions was, yes, you're right, Sullivan and Cromwell. Reading now from the Financial Times of July 3rd of 2002, this is an article by Edward Alden, A-L-D-E-N. Finance sector hits at moves to curb terror funds, and it reads in part as follows. The U.S. financial services industry has launched its first serious challenge to the slew of new regulations from Washington aimed at staunching the flow of funds to terrorist groups. The concerns spelled out this week by 11 industry trade groups representing nearly every major U.S. financial institution cast serious doubt on the U.S. administration's plans to implement the most important of those regulations by a July 23rd deadline. That was July 23rd of 2002. They could also mark the beginning of a split between the government and industry over just how much regulation is needed to discourage financing of terrorist groups. The Treasury Department wants all banks and other financial groups to set up elaborate schemes to monitor correspondent and private banking accounts opened in the U.S. by foreign banks or individuals. These are thought to be a main conduit for dirty money flowing into the U.S. financial system. The rules could also seriously disrupt established financial relationships, the letter warned. And skipping down. H. Rodgin Cohen, that's R-O-D-G-I-N, Cohen, C-O-H-G-N, a lawyer with Sullivan and Cromwell, who led the effort on behalf of the 11 groups, said the Treasury's definition of risky correspondent accounts was, quote, so broad that they pick up basically all relationships between U.S. financial institutions and foreign institutions and foreign financial institutions. And I would note that they were very much concerned that financial institutions in Russia and Egypt might be disrupted. Both Russia and Egypt have been focal points of Muslim Brotherhood agitation. The point being here that prominent banks hit back against attempts at interdicting terrorist money, basically lining up behind the old saw that this was unacceptable regulation. And I would note this was in July of 2002. In late 2002, then Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill resigned under pressure. And the Operation Green Quest raids of March 20th of 2002 were conducted in large measure under the auspices of the Treasury Department that runs the Secret Service. So we've got basically Sullivan and Cromwell, the old Dulles law firm, as the general counsel for Saudi bin Laden Group. We've got major U.S. financial institutions, the same institutions that were to wreak havoc on the U.S. and global economies in the latter part of that decade, the first decade of this century. We've got them opposing U.S. government and Treasury Department attempts at interdicting terrorist money flows, and walking point for those financial institutions is Sullivan and Cromwell, the old Dulles law firm, and the general counsel for Saudi bin Laden Group. And of course, the Bush family and the bin Laden families have been in business together for decades. What we're going to do now is to review the economic philosophy of the Muslim Brotherhood. And I think this will make clear, I hope it will make clear, why the Brotherhood is favored by the transnational corporations. From the book Dollars for Terror, The United States and Islam by Richard Laberriere, copyright 2000 by Algora Publishing. Taking Italy's choices under Mussolini for inspiration, the economic program set three priorities. The social policy foresaw a new law on labor founded on corporations. This economic program would more directly reveal its relationship to totalitarian ideologies a few years later with the works of Mohammad Ghazali, G-H-A-Z-A-L-I. Ghazali recommended, quote, an economic regimen similar to that which existed in Nazi Germany and fascist Italy. The moral code is also an important component in this program, which is intended to create the new Muslim man. That's just like the type of concept used by both Hitler and Mussolini. The new Muslim man. continuing, the notion of the equality of the sexes is inherently negated by the concept of the supremacy of male social responsibilities. The natural place of the woman is in the home. Hitler had something very similar. Kirsch und Kinder, basically. The place of the woman in the Third Reich was having kids and in the kitchen, cooking for the men and children. Of the actual contemporary economic philosophy of the Muslim Brotherhood and how it is received by the transnational corporation, we now turn to Newsweek magazine, the week of their issue of July 3rd and 10th of 2006. This article is called "Islam in Office" by Stephen Glain, G as in George, L-A-I-N, and skipping down.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing in, but by no means exclusively, economic and financial matters.
In Muslim liturgy, the deals cut in the soup became a metaphor for the contract between God and the faithful, and the business model Muhammad prescribed, according to Muslim scholars and economists, is very much in the laissez-faire tradition later embraced by the West. Prices were to be set by God alone, anticipating by more than a millennium Adam Smith's reference to the invisible hand, unquote, of market-based pricing. Merchants were not to cut deals outside the souk, an early attempt to thwart insider trading. In the days of the caliphate, Islam developed the most sophisticated monetary system the world had yet known. Today, some economists cite Islamic banking as further evidence of an intrinsic Islamic pragmatism. Though still guided by a Quranic ban on riba, or interest, Islamic banking has adapted to the needs of a booming oil region for liquidity. In recent years, some 500 Islamic banks and investment firms holding $2 trillion in assets have emerged in the Gulf states, with more in Islamic communities of the West. British Chancellor of the Exchequer Gordon Brown wants to make London a global center for Islamic finance and elicits no howl of protest from fundamentalists. How Islamists might run a central bank is more problematic. Scholars say they would manipulate currency reserves, not interest rates. The Muslim Brotherhood hails 14th century philosopher Ibn Khaldun as its economic guide. That, by the way, is spelled capital I-B-N, capital K-H-A-L-D-U-N. Anticipating supply-side economics, Khaldun argued that cutting taxes raises production and tax revenues, and that state control should be limited to providing water, fire, and free grazing land, the utilities of the ancient world. The World Bank has called Ibn Khaldun the first advocate of privatization. His founding influence is a sign of moderation. If Islamists in power ever do clash with the West, it won't be over commerce. But when the Muslim Brotherhood's chief economic theoretician, Ibn Khaldun, is cited by the World Bank as the first advocate of privatization, you can bet your hind legs that the transnational corporations and their associated political and national security elements view the Brotherhood with absolute adoration. And in fact, in addition to the corporatist economic philosophy, the Brotherhood is also being used as a proxy war-making element. In particular, in driving into the Caucasus and carving out that oil-rich region from Russia and hoping to gain dominance over the Earth Island. In addition to the September 11th attacks, there are indications that the Boston Marathon bombing was also blowback from a Western intelligence-backed operation in Chechnya. The tutor for Zokhar Tsarnaev was a guy named Brian Glynn Williams, a quote, ex-unquote CIA officer who worked in Afghanistan. The uncle, Uncle Ruslan, of both of the convicted, Tamerlane Tsarnaev was killed, but the Tsarnaev brothers' uncle, Uncle Ruslan, was the former son-in-law of Graham Fuller, a consummately important individual, very important individual, a CIA operations officer who wrote a paper that is credited with having basically birthed the Iran-Contra affair. He was CIA station chief in Kabul, Afghanistan, during the period in which Zbigniew Brzezinski, as we looked at in our discussions with Paul Fitzgerald and Elizabeth Gould on their book about Afghanistan, Afghanistan's untold story. We did four interviews with them, and whereas we were told that the Soviet Union just bulldozed into Afghanistan to add that to the Soviet Empire, in fact, Zbigniew Brzezinski, Jimmy Carter's national security advisor, set up a covert operation to lure the Soviets into Afghanistan so that it could become their Vietnam. And Graham Fuller was undoubtedly front and center in that operation. Fuller also set up an organization called Chechen International with his then son-in-law, Uncle Ruslan, the uncle of the Tsarnaev brothers. And again, at that, the mailing address for that was the address for Graham Fuller's Maryland address. And at that time, Uncle Ruslan was married to Graham Fuller's daughter. Mark Ains, an investigative reporter doing some of the very best work in the world, in my opinion, had an article in NSFWCorp.com of June 5th, 2013, Chechenian power, and we're going to excerpt that. Speaking of Graham Fuller, again, there are indications, as we looked at in For the Record 773, that the Boston Marathon bombing was blowback from an ongoing covert operation in Chechnya. In Chechenian power, Mark Ames writes, Graham Fuller comes from that faction of CIA cult warriors who believed and still apparently believe that fundamentalist Islam, even in its radical jihadi form, does not pose a threat to the West for the simple reason that fundamentalist Islam is conservative, against social justice, against socialism and redistribution of wealth, and in favor of hierarchical socioeconomic structures. Socialism is the common enemy to both capitalist America and to Wahhabi Islam, according to Fuller. According to journalist Robert Dreyfuss's book, Devil's Game, Fuller explained his attraction to radical Islam in neoliberal libertarian terms. There is no mainstream Islamic organization with radical social views. He wrote, he shouldn't have left-wing, so radical social views. Right-wing radical social views are part and parcel to Islam, but then that is corporatism, i.e. fascism. Continuing. Classical Islamic theory envisages the role of the state as limited to facilitating the well-being of markets and merchants rather than controlling them. Islamists have always powerfully objected to socialism and communism. Islam has never had problems with the idea that wealth is unevenly distributed. and more about Fuller and the Muslim Brotherhood. This from the Washington Post of September 11th of 2004 by John Mintz and Douglas Farah. In search of friends among the foes, U.S. hopes to work with diverse group. Some federal agents worry that the Muslim Brotherhood has dangerous links to terrorism, but some U.S. diplomats and intelligence officials believe its influence offers an opportunity for political engagement that could help isolate violent jihadists. "It is the preeminent movement in the Muslim world," unquote, said Graham E. Fuller, a former CIA official specializing in the Middle East. By the way, former belongs in quotes here. "It's something we can work with," unquote. "Demonizing the Brotherhood would be foolhardy in the extreme," he warned. And more about the Muslim Brotherhood. This from Salon.com of January 25th of 2012 by Avi Asher Shapiro, the GOP Brotherhood of Egypt. While Western alarmists often depict Egypt's Muslim Brotherhood as a shadowy organization with terrorist ties, the Brotherhood's ideology actually has more in common with America's Republican Party than with Al-Qaeda. I would interject, basically, there's not a hell of a lot of difference. I would note that following the Arab Spring, which was a U.S. intel operation that installed the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, they were eventually turned out by a coup. Egyptian intelligence charge of a fellow we're going to hear about here, Kairat al-Shatir, was a link between the Muslim Brotherhood and the Al-Qaeda leader Ayman al-Zawahiri. Muhammad al-Zawahiri, his brother, was something of a liaison between Morsi and his brother Ayman, who headed up Al-Qaeda. And following a meeting with Kairat al-Shatir, who also networked with Ann Patterson, the U.S. ambassador to Egypt, GOP Senators John McCain and Lindsey Graham met with Kairat al-Shatir. Afterward, Kairat al-Shatir transferred $50 million from the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood to Al-Qaeda. That discussed at length in For the Record 787. And due to the limitations of time, we cannot go into all of these connections, but there are links, and again, I can't encourage listeners strongly enough to use the descriptions on the SpitfireList.com website. This is a hybrid form of broadcasting meant to be read as well as listened to. Again, Salon.com, January 25th of 2012, the GOP Brotherhood of Egypt. While Western alarmists often depict Egypt's Muslim Brotherhood as a shadowy organization with terrorist ties, the Brotherhood's ideology actually has more in common with America's Republican Party than with Al-Qaeda. Few Americans know it, but the Brotherhood is a free market party led by wealthy businessmen whose economic agenda embraces privatization and foreign investment, while spurning labor unions and the redistribution of wealth. Like the Republicans in the U.S., the financial interests of the party's leadership of businessmen and professionals diverge sharply from those of its poor, socially conservative followers. The Brotherhood, which did not initially support the revolution that began a year ago, reaped its benefits, capturing nearly half of the seats in the new parliament, which was seated this week, and vaulting its top leaders into positions of power. Arguably, the most powerful man in the Muslim Brotherhood is Kairat al-Shatir, a multimillionaire tycoon whose financial interests extend into electronics, manufacturing, and retail. A strong advocate of privatization, al-Shatir is one of a cadre of Muslim Brotherhood businessmen who helped finance the Brotherhood's Freedom and Justice Party's impressive electoral victory this winter, and is now crafting the FJP's economic agenda. So that, again, about the philosophy of the Muslim Brotherhood and why it is a why it is held in such regard by the transnational corporations. And we're going to look at now are indications that the Muslim Brotherhood's offshoot Al-Qaeda, financed through the bank Al-Taqwa, has been financing the Chechen guerrillas. Russia recasts Bagh and Caucasus as war on terror by Stephen Lee Myers of the New York Times of October 5th of 2002. 3 years after Russian forces poured into Chechnya for the second time, the war grinds on, but Russia's characterization of the fight without end has changed. No longer are 85,000 Russian troops and police officers simply engaged in crushing a battle for independence. Instead, Chechnya has become Russia's war on terror.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site also features many articles not included in programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
I'm skipping down. Using the rationale and sometimes the rhetoric of the Bush administration's anti-terrorism campaign, commanders said this week that the Chechen war is financed, armed, and increasingly fought by Islamic militants from abroad. The shift explains Russia's roiling tensions with Georgia, the former Soviet republic bordering Chechnya that President Vladimir Putin has accused of sheltering what he calls Chechen and international terrorists. The accusations against Georgia, like the accusations against the Chechens, are sponsored by the Muslim Brotherhood and other foreign fighters, appear rooted in Russia's frustration and a desire to place external blame for the continued fighting. And indeed, there are indications that just exactly that has in fact been taking place. And what we're going to take a look at is an article about the, and I will have the reference in the description for the record, 862, more about the financing of the Chechen guerrillas through the bank Al-Taqwa. The president of the Al-Taqwa bank group is Youssef Mustafa Nada, naturalized Italian and a member of the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood and Jamaa al-Islamiyah, which is directly allied with Al-Qaeda through Dr. Ayman al-Zawahiri, said by some intelligence sources to be the brains behind bin Laden. When the Bahamas closed Al-Taqwa Bank Limited early this year, Swiss authorities required a name change in Al-Taqwa Bank, which then became registered in Switzerland as Nada Management Organization S.A. In 1970, Youssef Nada moved to Saudi Arabia and, with help from the Muslim Brotherhood, established contact with members of the Saudi royal family and founded a construction company in Riyadh, much the same as the bin Laden family. He remained active in Riyadh and soon founded the first Islamic bank in Egypt, the Faisal Bank. The Faisal Islamic Bank of Saudi Arabia is the head bank of a number of affiliated Islamic banks under that name across the Islamic world from Egypt to Pakistan to the Emirates and Malaysia. The head of the Faisal Islamic Bank of Saudi Arabia is former Saudi intelligence chief Turki al-Faisal. Faisal Islamic Bank is directly involved in running accounts for bin Laden and his associates, and has been named by Luxembourg banking authorities in this regard. In Sudan, Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda have been named as principals in the Shamal Bank in the 1990s. The bank transferred the funds for the U.S. embassy bombings in East Africa in 1998, according to trial testimony in New York. A 15% share in Al-Shamal is held by wealthy Saudi financier Saleh Abdullah Kamel of the Dalal al-Baraka Group, which owns the Jadah al-Baraka Bank. The other non-Sudanese shareholder of the Khartoum al-Shamal Bank is Faisal Islamic Bank. Russian FSB intelligence has charged that al-Baraka Bank was used by a Saudi religious charity, Al-Haramain, to funnel funds to Islamic terrorists tied to Al-Qaeda in Chechnya. And there are some very, very firm indications that, in fact, there is ongoing support for the Chechen guerrillas, and we'll talk about this in numerous programs, and we will come back to this. There is a very terrifying development that we will go into at greater length in, for the record, 863. We have already spoken about it in previous programs and in posts, and that is the appearance in Ukraine of Chechen fighters, Islamists associated with the Islamic State in, it's called ISIS, ISIL, and has other titles. But again, there are Chechen fighters who have been fighting against Russia and that have been fighting with the Islamic State in Syria and Iraq, and in particular in Syria, and they are now fighting in the Ukraine. And we, again, have spoken about this in a number of different posts. Warnings have been sounded that, in fact, the Chechen Islamist fighters may ultimately begin turning on the West. That, however, is not a source of great concern, I suspect, to the transnationals who are using the Islamists to gain control of the Earth Island. And we will go into the Chechen-Ukraine connection at greater length in, for the record, 863, as well as reviewing some elements here. We're going to conclude this program with an article from Consortium News. This is authored by Robert Perry. This is from September 10th, 2015. The Madness of Blockading Syria's Regime. And it reads in part, does the U.S. government want the Islamic State and or its fellow travelers in Al-Qaeda to take over Syria? As far as the State Department is concerned, that seems to be a risk worth taking as it moves to cut off Russia's supply pipeline to the Syrian government of President Bashar al-Assad, even as Sunni terrorist groups expand their grip on Syrian territory. It appears that hardliners within the Obama administration have placed the neocon goal of regime change in Syria ahead of the extraordinary dangers that could come from the black flag of Sunni terrorism raised over the capital of Damascus. That would likely be accompanied by the Islamic State chopping off the heads of Christians, Alawites, Shiites, and other heretics, and or Al-Qaeda having a major Mideast capital from which to plot more attacks on the West. And as destabilizing as the current flow of Middle East refugees is to Europe, a victory by the Islamic State or Al-Qaeda's Nusra Front would open the floodgates, sending millions of desperate people pouring out of Syria and creating a political as well as humanitarian crisis. At that point, there would also be enormous pressure on President Barack Obama or his successor to mount a full-scale invasion of Syria and attempt a bloody occupation. The human and financial costs of this nightmare scenario are almost beyond comprehension. The European Union, already strained by mass unemployment on its southern tier, could crack apart. The United States could also undergo a final transformation from a republic into a permanent warrior state. Yet official Washington can't seem to stop itself. Instead of working with Russia and Shiite-ruled Iran to help stabilize the political, military situation in Syria, the pundit class and the tough guy, tough gal politicians are unleashing torrents of insults toward the two countries that would be the West's natural allies in any effort to prevent a Sunni terrorist takeover. Beyond words, there has been action. Over the past week, the State Department has pressured Bulgaria and Greece to bar Russian transport flights headed to Syria. The U.S. plan seems to be to blockade the Syrian government and starve it of outside supplies, whether humanitarian or military, all the better to force its collapse and open the Damascus city gates to the Islamic State and or Al-Qaeda. In explaining its nearly inexplicable behavior, the State Department even has adopted the silly neocon talking point which blames Assad and now Russia for creating the Islamic State through the bloodthirsty group actually originated as Al-Qaeda in Iraq in reaction to President George W. Bush's invasion of Iraq in 2003. Then, backed by money and weapons from Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and other U.S. quote allies unquote, AQI moved into Syria with the goal of ousting Assad's relatively secular government. AQI later took the name Islamic State, also known by the acronyms ISIS, ISIL, or Daesh. Yet the State Department's official position is that the Islamic State is Assad's and Russia's fault. Skipping down. Yet the reality is that Assad's military has been the principal bulwark against both the Islamic State and the other dominant Sunni rebel force, Al-Qaeda's affiliate, the Nusra Front. So, by moving to shut down Assad's supply line, the U.S. government is, in effect, clearing the way for an Islamic State, Al-Qaeda victory, since the U.S.-trained, quote, moderate, unquote, rebels are largely a faction numbering in double digits, while the extremists have tens of thousands of committed fighters. I think Robert Perry's remarks are well taken. However, they are, of course, limited in their perspective. As I have tried to convey, the Muslim Brotherhood and the leader of ISIS is a, quote, former, unquote, note the quotes, member of the Muslim Brotherhood. And also, by the way, someone who was actually in a U.S. military prison in Iraq. And the Muslim Brotherhood is not something that is viewed with disfavor by the transnationals, and there are the firmest indications that in Chechnya and now in Ukraine, and as we will see in part two, for the record, 863, they are also being used against China as well. However, that will have to wait until, for the record, 863, which I hope to have completed by the end of this weekend. This concludes, for the record, program number 862. 9/11, the Muslim Brotherhood, and the Earth Island Boogie. This is being recorded on September 11th of 2015.